appropriate the dollars to pay the $50,000. Okay. Right?
Right.
That's really what it's about.
Checks in the mail.
Right. It's that's the small. Illinois, huh? Yeah.
And so Senate Bill 2273, I think, is what you're speaking to, which says that we can only participate in ERIC and not in CrossCheck. Yeah. And so it passed the Senate 35-17, I believe, and it will be going on to the House soon. And so, but it's unfortunate that we have to push for a legislative measure when the Illinois State Board of Elections could just look at all the data and just say, hey, you know what? We're done with CrossCheck. We're only going to participate in the ERIC program.
What I was concerned about, and we talked about it once before, is if Illinois withdraws from it, does that mean other states can't use the files?
So
I'm more concerned with other states. I am concerned about Illinois disqualifying voters, clearly. Yeah. But the names that come out of Illinois could
well, we wouldn't give our data to the CrossCheck program anymore. Yeah. So we wouldn't be able to use people from the state of Illinois. Our names and data wouldn't be a part of that system anymore. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the part about us not giving up the data, and it's not being secured the way that it should. So that's a big concern. That's why Kentucky just left CrossCheck. As well, they just bowed out. As we were talking about Kentucky being the place that was the first place for
enfranchising non-property.
So anyway,
they was the ones who was holding one of the storage units was in Kentucky. So Kentucky just withdrew from CrossCheck.
Yeah.
So the little house of cards, it's crumbled.
Well, Quebec deserves it. But well, they're going to move all of their voter suppression into the Homeland Security office, they said, right?
We'll keep fighting.
Yeah.
They're going to keep, and to your point, they're going to continue to try to move stuff, so we've got to push it. So there's going to be some more work doing around this. Look forward to learning more about the ERIC program, why we should get out of CrossCheck, but more importantly, why you all should take the necessary steps to get out there and vote early. Vote by mail if you need to. You do not need an excuse to do that. You can vote absentee if you so choose. But look for your sample ballots, Paul. This is something that I really want to drive
home
to people. Once you put your name and information in for your voter information on the county clerk's website, you will get a sample ballot that should be ready either this week or possibly next week at the latest. It should be ready to go no later than the 21st of February. And you'll be able to see what exactly your ballot is going to look like. And you can research the candidates. You can research any particular questions. And you can actually print that out, fill it out, and take it into the voting booth with you so that you know exactly what you plan to do when you go vote. Please take advantage of your sample ballot when you have that opportunity to do so. It should be up on the county clerk's website no later than February 21st.
All right. Thanks for the update on that.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, brother.
Yeah. Have a good afternoon. And to all you out there, midday greetings, 10 o'clock. I guess I've been up for a while. It seems like it's already been a while. So what do I have today? I've got something on the nuclear war. I'll reprise the February 10th event, Women in the Prevention of Nuclear War. Wish everybody luck. Have some details on that. But Con Hollinen of the Institute for Policy Studies, one of the longest standing leftist think tanks in D.C. area, activist, very storied place. I could go on for a while. They're at ips-dc.org if you want to look at it. And Hollinen writes under their outreach to the media. They have some effect. They aren't in the Rolodex. I've never even heard Hollinen except on Pacifica. So that's about 24 minutes long. I've got the Intercept discussion between Jeremy Scahill and his colleague at the Intercept, Naomi Klein. They're sort of doing a SALT-2 State of the Union roundup, though also talking about Puerto Rico a little bit. I guess she's been, Naomi Klein's been down there and is going to be doing some articles from her trip there for The Intercept. This is The Intercepted podcast. Lots of great stuff. A long discussion with Juan Gonzalez about sort of around his book, The Harvest of Empire, which contends even more clearly that what the American Empire has wrought is dislocation of people in our backyard, and that's generally why many of them have to flee here because of the economic and particularly the violence that's been ravaging a lot of Latin America, particularly Central America, which is where most of the people fleeing are now fleeing from, it seems. Okay, we're going to kick it off with, don't have much for Black History Month. Maybe I'll do something tomorrow, although I think I want to get to the Juan Gonzalez segment tomorrow from The Intercepted. Mumia Abu-Jamal's got a couple commentaries, kind of. One of them's not really a commentary, but it marks the passing of Hugh Masekela, a really important guy in the anti-apartheid struggle. His wife for a time, Miriam Makeba, was quite the activist as well. Before she married Kwame Ture? I'm getting my Black history mixed up. I need to study this. But let's kick it off with Mumia's commentary on the State of the Union as well. And then we'll get to Jeremy Scahill's with Naomi Klein, Khan Halanan with Brian Edwards Tickert of KPFA, not from the show Up Front, not one I get to too frequently. Let's see. I guess we'll play it from here.
A state of disunion. Like every president before him, Donald Trump announced that the State of the Union is strong, his Queen's accent giving a double count to the last word. But this is what presidents are expected to say. Could you imagine an American president saying anything else? What if a president dared speak a simple truth that the State of the Union is broken? For that it was. If politics is part pageantry, it's also essentially the art of division between parties. One party crows, the other party simmers. That great student of America, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic 1835 work, Democracy in America, opined, "The parties by which the Union is menaced do not rest on abstract principles, but upon temporal interests. These interests, disseminated in the provinces of so vast an empire, may be said to constitute rival nations rather than parties." De Tocqueville was writing these words just a few years before the Union burst into its bloodiest war, the U.S. Civil War. He was feeling and sensing in the air a great discontent, like now. The discontent, often due to the steering pot of politics by Trump, is palpable. Party versus party, nation versus nation, disunity, the very essence of politics. Trump, his chin jutting into the air, projected the politics of fear of others, mostly of brown people, dark invaders. Let's be honest. There is no State of the Union. There's only a state of disunion. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
There were people who remember your grazing in the grass days of the late 60s and what that meant to black people who were young and needed to hear different forms of music coming from black people in other parts of the world. How have you seen yourself as a musician?
I think of myself more as a very grateful person. I'm grateful, you know, to God that I have the gift that I have. I look at it as a very spiritual thing. I give it a lot of respect, and I play with musicians who are very respectful of that. You know, I have a great reverence for it. So I don't really have what you would call a very complicated vision of it. You know, I don't think of myself as a cultist figure. I don't think of myself as a person with a mysterious situation, you know. I think myself mostly like as a part of the international black community that is my inspiration.
That sounds like a very young Mumi Abu-Jamal when he was a stringer for WHYY, NPR Philadelphia, where Fresh Air comes from. I guess he has a cooperative colleague who might have gotten that archival recording. Again, he needs a fair trial. He's not on death row, but he's on slow death row. He did get treatment for hepatitis C, but there were some health complications I just heard about. But he sounds like he's doing okay again from his product at prisonradio.org. Occasionally I'll go into the story about how what a lousy trial he got and the likely scenario of what really happened that night in Philly. Bad cops eliminating two of their opponents at the same time is what I think happened. I didn't mention Amy Goodman. Of course, she's got her Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, which we'll get to right now, and then we'll hopefully do some announcements. I'll let you know what's happening at the top of the hour with Behind the News. That's a new show for this time slot, relatively new, Doug Henwood's product. And I haven't gone back to hear all of Vijay Prashad's interview from last week. I need to do that. I was running some errands. Anyway, here's Amy breaking the sound barrier.
The stateless of the union. Trump's war on immigrants. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
Yes, first speaker, the President of the United States.
President Donald Trump delivered his first State of the Union address Tuesday night. It was to be his clarion call to bipartisanship. Instead, under the guise of a compromise position on the fate of nearly 800,000 DACA, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals recipients, Trump bashed Latino immigrants just like he did on the day he launched his presidential campaign in 2015, when he said of Mexican immigrants,
"They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists."
Hours before the State of the Union, U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garofas in New York released a scathing rebuke of Trump during a court hearing on whether Trump's cancellation of DACA was illegal. The judge said he would not ignore the president's, quote, vicious, recurring, redundant drumbeat of anti-Latino commentary, unquote. The judge's words could have served as a summary of Trump's State of the Union address. Many members of Congress had invited special guests to attend the State of the Union, among them Dreamers, undocumented immigrants, and their advocates. Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar of Arizona asked the U.S. Capitol Police to check the identification of all those attending and to arrest undocumented immigrants in attendance. His request was ignored. For millions of immigrants and their family members around the U.S., the State of the Union was not just a political speech. Their lives hang in the balance. President Barack Obama enacted DACA through executive order in 2012, allowing people who were brought to the U.S. as children without proper documentation to register with the federal government in order to receive a work permit and protection from deportation. Among other things, they undergo a background check and provide their address and biometric data. Commonly referred to as Dreamers, they are in essence stateless. Their status in the U.S. is uncertain, but they have little or no connection to their nation of origin. Older immigrants, the more than 10 million people here without documentation but who do not qualify for DACA, are in similar straits, living under the daily threat of arrest and deportation, living in the shadows. Trump cited the U.S.-based Salvadoran criminal gang MS-13 four times in a speech, fanning the flames of racism and fear of violent crime. As a sop to Democrats, he suggested 1.8 million Dreamers, who we referred to only as illegal immigrants, might be given a pathway to citizenship. But in exchange, he demanded a slew of restrictive changes to U.S. immigration policy, which would be the most significant overhaul in more than half a century, including the elimination of the green card lottery, limiting family unification by preventing immigrants from joining family members already in the U.S., and $25 billion to build a border wall and to further militarize the U.S.-Mexico border. Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington invited a woman who's been targeted for deportation by the Trump administration. Mara Mora Villalpando is a leader of the group Northwest Detention Center Resistance. The morning after the State of the Union, Mara Mora Villalpando told us on the Democracy Now! News Hour,
"He scapegoated my community along with many other communities, but it was important to show that we're not afraid and we're going to continue in the struggle."
Despite boycotting the speech herself, Brooklyn Congressmember Yvette Clark invited immigrant leader Ravi Ragbir, executive director of the New York City-based New Sanctuary Coalition. Remarkably, he had just been released from nearly 3 weeks of detention the night before. He was detained by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, on January 11th at his check-in and rushed into deportation proceedings. Mass protests and legal action prevented his deportation to Trinidad and Tobago on January 12th. A judge then ordered him returned from the Chrome Detention Center in Florida back to a New York detention center while his case proceeded. Then, in a stunning decision on Monday, U.S. District Judge Catherine B. Forrest ordered Ravi Ragbir immediately released. She wrote, "It ought not to be, and it has never before been, that those who have lived without incident in this country for years are subjected to treatment we associate with regimes we revile as unjust, regimes where those who have long lived in a country may be taken without notice from streets, home, and work, and sent away. We're not that country, and woe be the day when we become that country under a fiction that laws allow it. We have a law higher than any that may be so interpreted, and that is our Constitution," she wrote. The opening words of the U.S. Constitution are, "We the people, far more powerful than any single president. It's that collective force that will save us." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Indeed. It's a civil violation most places. I guess some places have made immigration infractions a criminal offense. It's not the way it was ever thought of until... We needed scapegoats, I guess. There's a big march today. It's variously called Dream Act Now by the Immigration Forum, and some other supporting groups are calling it Bend the Arc. And it's focused on media, from starting on South Neil, WCIA. It's a short little hike, they only intend it to be from 11:30 to 12:30, so... just an hour, some chanting and singing, and walking down Neal Street to downtown Champaign, to what's called here the News Gazette offices. But a while back, News Gazette consolidated their radio outlet, WDWS. At least I think this is the case. Apparently they're in the lobby broadcasting, or you can see them. That's where Rush Limbaugh originates from in our media market, if you want to think about it that way. So... not your gray cloth Republicans, it seems to me. He's been particularly rabid this week. Don't have too much about the memo. Have you read the memo? There's not much there. It reminds me of what was said about Oakland's downtown. There's no there. And the memo itself points out that this Carter Page was already being curried by some Russian operatives as long ago as 2012, I think I heard today. I've heard variously 2013. He's quite an odd bird. What gives a lie to the whole hypocrisy of this FISA expose memo is that the week before they voted, most of them voted in favor of this thing that I covered last week, the renewal of that section of the Patriot Act that allows for surveillance and abuses are rampant. They were rampant through the Obama era as far as getting okays, but they voted for it, so they don't. That's not seriously. It's just a foil, basically, to poke at, and it's not a very good one. John Dean called it a fraud. Another ex-CIA said what I said, which is there's no there at all to speak of. Some people shared opposition. I was thinking about playing something from The Intercept. Did I go back to the woman from Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler, said on Democracy Now? Before the memo was released, she pointed out exactly what would be pretty much lacking, the context. I generally oppose the rampant surveillance, but it wasn't because of the Steele memo. Marcy Wheeler is asked to comment about a Wall Street Journal article that I haven't searched out yet that contends that the whole Steele thing was pretty much a contrivance of what's now called the something else, but the KGB, Russian intelligence manipulating, which I think is overblown and probably not too likely. But anyway, you can read the memo. It's out now. The headline on WLL was frustrating yesterday because they talked about the 5-day period to decide whether to release or what to redact, and it had already hit the internet. So, like I said, there's not much there. Some family ties in the opposition. Marcy Wheeler was interviewed on Intercepted, I believe it was just last week. They all kind of run together, and it was informative. There was one thing that I wanted to follow up on. There was a lot of money in the Never Trump that came from the Republican side. There was a hedge fund guy who was a major donor to Republicans. Greg Palast calls him the Vulture Fund guy because he's one of his specialities is buying devalued loans and then extracting money out of third lesser developed countries. But Peter Singer was really opposed to Trump, and he funded some research, opposition research group, to look at the mob ties particularly. And that's never been released. So I was joking, it's sort of hedge fund managers' compromat, compromising material. And everything would have been different if Felix Satter, who was a colleague of her business partner with Trump at the Trump Soho development, he was really mobbed up too with the Russian oligarchs. And he got out of a charge by being a cooperative witness for the FBI. But he didn't give witness against Trump for some reason. I guess they were focusing on the Russian oligarchs and not our local oligarchs. Things would have been different if Felix Satter had been asked questions about Trump. But deference to American billionaires is monumental, isn't it? All right, that's enough about that. I didn't say anything outro-wise, did I, about Hugh Masekela? Well, I did in the intro. Let's now hear, and it includes a little satiric piece, as usual, starting off The Intercepted. And Naomi Klein in conversation with Jeremy Scahill about the theory of everything, but it's sort of teeing off on the State of the Union address. They even get to some fashion comments from Naomi Klein. You'll hear it there. One thing I wanted to mention is they talk about Walmart's, or they mention in passing Walmart's well-advertised $1,000 bonus. Turns out if you look in the details of that, it's only for people that are vested in Walmart, people that have worked there 20 years. And if you know anything about the turnover at Walmart, it wasn't a lot of money. But they sure did get a lot of press out of it, didn't they?
The crew of Discovery One consists of 5 men and one of the latest generation of the HAL 9000 computers. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Station, this is your president. Do you hear me?
Hal, despite your enormous intellect...
Do you hear me?
Are you ever frustrated by your dependence on people to carry out actions?
We have astronauts and we have everybody. We're flying right now. We're learning. They're learning about space, learning about a lot of other things. Racing into space. So excited about space. Space flight. Space station. Love space and think about space.
Look, Dave, I can't put my finger on it, but I sense something strange about it.
So many other things having to do with NASA and space.
If you were proven to be malfunctioning, I wouldn't see how we'd have any choice but disconnection.
Join us from orbit, astronaut.
We'd have to cut his higher brain functions.
Yeah. Well, that's far safer than allowing Hal to continue running things.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I think you're ready. I know you're ready, right?
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
Which one of you is ready to go to Mars?
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
17,000 miles per hour. That's about as fast as I've ever heard. I wouldn't want to be flying 17,000 miles an hour, but that's what you do.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
So we'll have to speed that up a little bit, okay?
Hal!
Who's ready to go to Mars up there?
Hal!
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, First Lady of the United States, and my fellow Americans.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 42 of Intercepted.
For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans.
Donald Trump's State of the Union speech was an assault on immigrants. It added gas to an already incendiary situation with North Korea. Trump also announced a new executive order to support his plan to start sending new prisoners to Guantanamo. What he basically did was to reverse Barack Obama's 2009 order that Guantanamo prison needed to be closed. Of course, that didn't happen under Obama. But what's becoming clear is that Trump intends to start sending new prisoners to Guantanamo. Trump also said that his administration believes that terrorists, a term that Trump did not define, are unlawful combatants. And he also seemed to be referencing a return to tactics that many of us believe were torture.
Terrorists who do things like place bombs in civilian hospitals are evil. When possible, we have no choice but to annihilate them. When necessary, we must be able to detain and question them. But we must be clear, terrorists are not merely criminals. They are unlawful enemy combatants.
During a speech, Trump won praise on Twitter from Ku Klux Klan jackass David Duke for this hateful line mocking immigrants known as dreamers.
Because Americans are dreamers too.
In his speech, Trump carried out a verbal assault on immigrant rights, and he advanced policies that would result in an even more dramatic uptick in raids that are being conducted by ICE agents and other federal agencies. Trump repeatedly referenced the MS-13 street gang, which was founded in California in the 1980s. Trump had invited two families whose children were killed, reportedly by members of MS-13. Now, I can't even imagine the pain of losing your child. And what happened to the daughters of from these families is a horrific crime. At the same time, Trump was not really making a point about these grieving families as much as he was using their horrifying nightmare to push his policies. Trump was speaking about MS-13 like it represents some nation-state level threat to American security, like MS-13 carried out 9/11.
Many of these gang members took advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as illegal, unaccompanied, alien minors.
MS-13 is a heinous criminal group, no doubt. But Trump was using classic Trump scaremongering to exaggerate the actual threat that MS-13 represents. Trump used it as a way of attacking immigrants. He used it as a dog whistle. MS-13 is a gang that was started by young Salvadorans in California in the 1980s. Trump wants hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans deported. Are they members of MS-13? No. Many of them are people who actually fled a U.S.-fueled war in El Salvador and its ongoing aftermath. A lot of them pay taxes, and a lot of them are here legally right now. All of Trump's posturing was part of his cruel campaign to deport hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of people. He used this speech to defend the building of his wall, to further paramilitarize law enforcement, and to expand raids. That's what all of this was about.
We have proposed new legislation that will fix our immigration laws and support our ICE and Border Patrol agents. These are great people. These are great, great people.
Oh, and for all the praise that Trump heaped on the military and how they're crushing ISIS left and right, he made no mention of the four U.S. soldiers killed in Niger. And we still don't know the full story of what happened there. On North Korea, Trump used the family of American Otto Warmbier, who died shortly after being freed from a North Korean prison. He died when he was returned to the United States. And Trump also used the story of a North Korean who escaped the country and had a harrowing, terrible story. Trump was using these people as props to justify his warmongering and his dangerous pissing match that could actually lead to a nuclear war. The whole thing was pretty sick. Joining me now is my colleague, Naomi Klein, who just left Puerto Rico, where she's been on the ground working on a series of reports. Naomi, welcome back to Intercepted.
It's great to be back with you, Jeremy.
Well, this speech that Stephen Miller wrote for Donald Trump was pretty terrifying, I thought. What was your sense?
Yeah, it was a really chilling speech. The parts about immigration were completely sick and exploitative, and just using this family's pain and the fact that these two families had lost their daughters to paint all immigrants as criminals and justify the wall. And I mean, I think the way he spoke about the Dreamers was one of the scariest points, talking about the generosity and just the crassness of the quid pro quo. I think the racism of the speech, I mean, I think Kianga Yamada Taylor tweeted that it was like watching a Klan rally. I mean, it really was incredible. And using, you know, a 12-year-old boy who was putting a flag on gravestones as an opportunity to take a shot at Colin Kaepernick. I mean, it was a truly awful speech. I was mad at the people who were, you know, playing drinking games watching it, because it really is, it's nothing to joke about. There are so many lives on the line. And, you know, the cheering for Guantanamo, the cheering for torture, the cheering for increasing the nuclear arsenal. I mean, then there's climate change, which we could talk about as well.
It's clear that the departments within the executive branch that would, you know, typically feed a president a chunk of the speech to cover their territory. It's like incredible when you compare Trump and the number of topics that he ran through and sort of talked about as a sporting event. And then you contrast that with, like, did he make any serious proclamations about anything regarding the climate in this or the economy?
No, not at all. I mean, the incredible irony to me, I guess, is starting with, you know, we've been through so much in this past year and going straight to these record-breaking climate change-related fires in California, Hurricane Harvey, Maria, you know, he mentioned Puerto Rico, of course, doesn't mention what is driving these extraordinary events, heaps praise on the first responders, and then goes on to heap praise on beautiful, clean coal. I mean, I don't know if anyone other than Donald Trump has ever called coal beautiful, you know, praising ExxonMobil for investing $35 billion in new fossil fuel projects, not renewables, and praising himself for eliminating pollution control regulations on the auto industry, which he claims is going to create some huge boom in Detroit, which is bullshit. But the contradictions there were certainly stark. I mean, you can never say shocking, but it was striking the way he was praising just their incredible performance, leading with the amazing performance in responding to these disasters at a time when 35% of Puerto Ricans are without power right now. And FEMA has just announced that they're cutting off food and water aid. They announced that yesterday. You know, there was no major policy announcement. It just underlined, you know, what an extraordinary moment we're living in.
And on the issue of Israel, you know, Donald Trump referenced his, you know, very bold move that he's going to put the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. And he referenced this vote that happened recently at the United Nations, where the vast majority of nations in the world voted to condemn the U.S. position and to urge member states not to relocate their embassies. Trump openly said that he wants Congress to cut off U.S. aid to any country that didn't support the United States on a vote involving ultimately questions of Israel.
And I think it was wider ranging than that threat to cut off aid, which got a huge round of applause. I think it was also a threat to Pakistan, if I was understanding that well.
Well, I mean, look, we see the clear evidence of collusion between Israel and the Trump administration. I mean, there's a lot that's sort of right there for the taking, and no one really talks about it. While Donald Trump was speaking, Naomi, they posted on the White House website a executive order that Trump referenced in his speech, this presidential executive order. And it's, the title is Presidential Executive Order on Protecting America Through Lawful Detention of Terrorists. And we heard Trump openly say they're going to start putting people back at Guantanamo. And he appeared to be asserting openly and publicly that his administration intends to go back to some version of what Dick Cheney and George W. Bush attempted to implement, you know, with the CIA and in other places around the world. But Trump is openly saying we are going to categorize anyone that we're engaged in a war with as an enemy combatant, and therefore we can treat them outside of the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, I think that was probably the most substantive announcement of the speech in terms of kind of new information, what he said about Guantanamo in light of the fact that we are seeing, we also saw bragging about the fact that the war in Afghanistan is now endless, right? I mean,
but now with new and improved rules of engagement, and he didn't cite what those were, but the military people who were applauding know what he's talking about. He's expanded the rules, allowing commanders to make judgments on the spot about conducting operations that quite likely will kill civilians. He's basically removed the already sort of low-level restrictions that were put in place by the Obama administration. That's what he's talking about when he said, you know, updated rules of engagement.
Yeah. And then I think what we've got on the economy was pretty much expected, right? I mean, in terms of the bragging about the stock market, which, of course, is not something that is improving the daily lives of the majority of Americans. And the fact that there's so much anger out there is largely because there is a disconnect between what's good for wealthy people in the country and what's good for people who are playing the stock market and what you know, is meaningful for regular working people.
One point on that, and I don't know if this is just me or if other people have this sense, but somehow watching this orange billionaire reality TV host talking about the tax bill and then emphasizing how $4,000, that's a lot of money.
I mean, that's a lot of money.
There's
yeah.
But there's something that the way that he was talking about, you know, what they've done on deductions and how this has resulted in all these, you know, Walmart bonuses where people all of a sudden are given, you know, a check. And it's really remarkable given that how much money he has, how wasteful his administration has been, how much it cost when Melania didn't want to live with him to fly her back and forth for 3 months, how much it cost to secure all of his golf outings and how much they're
billing. Although her facial expressions tonight were priceless.
Okay, I will say, yes. All right. I mean, not to get off into too much of a tangent here, but I do really hope that the shade that Melania Trump seems to be constantly throwing at Donald these days, I hope that is truly based on real kind of hatred of him or despising him, and that it's how it seems to be publicly to us.
Yeah, and there was a couple points where she was pointedly not standing up when other people were standing up.
This is going to be like, some kind of a weird TMZ segment we're doing here. But also, I thought interesting, she had the eggshell white suit on,
You know what? She didn't stand up for Americans Are Dreamers, too, which was a big applause line.
Interesting. All right. Well, yeah. Naomi Klein, we're going to always have you to do the red carpets on the State of the Union address. Before we wrap up, you just left Puerto Rico. You are there on a reporting trip. We're going to see the fruits of that on The Intercept in the coming days and weeks. But give people a sense of what is happening on the ground right now in Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico has just been booby-trapped at every turn to make this disaster, which was already supercharged by climate change, just have the worst possible impact, you know, and, you know, whether it was the debt and the austerity and how the infrastructure was booby-trapped to collapse, or just the systems of economic development, the colonial relationship that was designed to exacerbate dependency. Like Puerto Rico, even though it's this incredibly sunny archipelago and could be getting its energy from fossil fuels, from wind, from wave power, they get all of their power from imported fossil fuels. And I think one of the most striking things is being on Vieques, where you feel that double dependency because they import all of their energy from the United States to Puerto Rico, and then it's pumped through a pipeline from the main island of Puerto Rico to Vieques, and that pipeline ruptured. So just these systems of dependency are just baked in. And because they were set up to be dependent on the United States, on agriculture, on energy, in all of these ways, when the system broke, it just maximized impact and still is. You know, and I was also there when they announced they were privatizing the energy system and introduced this fiscal plan that will close hundreds of schools. So it was an incredibly intense time to be in Puerto Rico, and I hope I can come back and talk not just about that, but about the incredible ways that Puerto Ricans are responding and putting forward their own solutions and building them in the rubble of this failed system. Because the really amazing thing, Jeremy, is that I saw some of the most hopeful things I've ever seen in my life while I was in Puerto Rico, as well as some of the most enraging and upsetting.
Well, we all are looking forward to reading your
Naomi Klein, and she'll be writing
Naomi
about
Klein,
that
my
for
colleague
the Intercept.
At the
running,
Intercept. Thanks so much for joining us
short
again on Intercept.
On time here.
Thanks, Jeremy. Great talking with you.
Naomi Klein is my colleague
okay,
at the Intercept.
Okay, next Saturday is this
books.
Role
Most
of women
recently,
against
no,
nuclear
is not enough. Look for her
war?
Reporting on Puerto Rico
be A-N-D
in the coming
is
days
a
at Intercept.
Chapter that's going to be starting here. This is Khan Hallinan. I guess he's introduced. No, I guess I was going to cut off the introduction here. With,
up front, I'm Brian.
Brian Edwards Tiekert from the morning show out on the left coast. So the specifics of the event at the IMC are right in front of me, but I did want to slew forward to make sure we get the concluding segment of this interview on, again, Khan Hallinan with the Institute for Policy Studies, one of the longest think tanks in D.C. It's 2 to 4 next week. Today, of course, 11:30 to 12:30 in March from WAND to... the News Gazette and the WDWS offices, I'm calling it, the media conglomerate there. Starting at 11:30 to 12:30, I already said that. Sponsored by a couple of different groups, including the CU Immigration Forum. I don't know if I'm going to hit the street or not. I'm still gauging that. Here's Brian Edwards Tiekert and Khan Hallinan. It doesn't talk about this new doomsday underwater drone that's being talked about in defense circles. It's sort of the ultimate Russian parry of the idea of a first strike by the U.S. At least that's the way it looks to me. They don't discuss that, but be very afraid.
To shift 60% of the Americans' military force into the Pacific Basin. So for the first time since the end of World War II, the Americans have ground troops and warplanes deployed in Australia. They have revived a number of their major bases in the Philippines. They've deployed anti-missile systems in South Korea and Japan. There's an enormous buildup of stuff. The possibility of a sort of what they call a bloody nose is the term that the administration is using, an attack on North Korea that would be a sort of a warning shot, maybe a use of a tactical nuclear weapon, a low-yield nuclear weapon, or even conventional forces to attack one of their ICBMs, to attack maybe command and control, etc., is talked about all the time. And in fact, I saw a figure from within the administration that thought that there was about a 30% chance of such an attack taking place.
So this is something that people in the military establishment right now think is a viable military tactic, a small nuke.
Well, yes and no. The military has always been a little uncertain about nuclear weapons because there are a number of people in the military who don't think you can have a limited nuclear war. And so what they see is that once you use a nuclear weapon, then suddenly you're in a situation where it's going to get out of control very quickly. But the military, you know, the two most common words in the U.S. military is yes, sir. So if they get ordered to do something, they'll do it.
The specific concern here with the B-2s, as I understand it, is a newish type of bomb called the B-61.
Yeah, it's a bunker buster. It actually isn't a new bomb. It's an old bomb. It's reconfigured. It's a low yield. It can go anywhere from about 300,000 or about 30 kilos, 300,000 kilos of explosive force, all the way up to about 475 kilotons. Now, to give you an idea of what that means, the Hiroshima bomb was 15 kilotons. The Nagasaki bomb was a little larger. So when you're talking about something like 475 kilotons, you're talking about something very different than we think of as nuclear war, which in our case was Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So a small bomb today is 300 times the explosive force of Hiroshima.
Here's an example. One of the problems about nuclear war, and why I think there's this kind of casualness in which people talk about it, you know, William Perry, the former U.S. Secretary of Defense, wrote a book last year in which he said that the danger is greater today of a nuclear war than it was at the height of the Cold War. And Perry is a guy who was in on the ground floor of nuclear weapon development, so he really knows what he's talking about. I think part of the problem is the size of the explosive force of these weapons. If you translated Hiroshima into explosive force, it would represent 27 freight cars filled with TNT. Now, of course, none of that is radioactive, so you got to add radioactivity on top of that. A 1 megaton warhead would be a train 300 miles long. The Russian RS-20, which is their basic ICBM, packs 10 megatons of explosive force. And I think one of the problems is that there's nothing in our lives which give us that experience of something with that enormous explosive force. So that even the standard weapon, the two standard weapons in the American arsenal, are the W-76, which is 100 kilotons, and the W-88, which is 475 kilotons. So the one W-76 again, how do you put your head around that? And I think part of it is that people really have a hard time imagining the enormous force involved.
One of the points your column made is that the United States still bases its military planning on something called a counterforce capacity. That's maintaining the capacity to preemptively eliminate any rivals' nuclear facilities.
Well, also, the United States has always had a first strike. That's, if you look at U.S. doctrine, they have always called for first strike. Now, part of the first strike is what they call counterforce. And counterforce is you aim at the other person's nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, recent technological developments in the way that nuclear weapons explode, that is what they call the superfuse, has now, according to a study by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, has now reconfigured the kind of smaller nuclear warheads, the W-76, so that they are now capable of destroying all of Russia's land-based ICBM force and still keep 80% of the U.S.'s warheads in reserve. So in other words, what we could do is launch a first strike, destroy all of the Russians' ICBMs. And the Russians don't have strategic bombers, so they can't really deliver them that way. They do have some missile-firing submarines, but a lot of them are pretty old, and there's not that many of them. So essentially what we could do would be to knock out the entire ICBM force, land-based ICBM, and then say, okay, if you respond, we have 80% of our nuclear weapons left, we will simply extinguish you as a civilization, so surrender. And that's part of the plan.
Which puts Russia in the situation of the only alternative to surrendering being use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it.
And you find out the American bombs and missiles are incoming, you have a few minutes to get your own into the air before they're wiped out.
About 15 minutes is what they figure the Russians have. We have better satellite detection, so we have about 30 minutes. And there have been a number of cases. It was, you know, a recent case in which the Norwegians fired a weather rocket. And the Russians detected it, and they detected it as an ICBM incoming from the North Atlantic. A very standard scenario for beginning a nuclear war is to detonate a very large warhead, a B-63, which is 1.2 megatons, at about 6 miles altitude above a country. And what that does is it puts out a huge, enormous electromagnetic pulse, and it fries all of your electronics. So essentially, your society sort of stops in mid-step. And so they detected this, and they decided to ignore it. But at what point do you have someone who makes the wrong decision. And in the case of the Russians, that's a real problem, because the current North Atlantic Treaty Organization doctrine of use of nuclear weapons, and I can actually quote from it, is to increase the burden of doubt in an adversary. There should be no specific nuclear threshold. Now, you want to think about that for a minute. You want to keep the other side guessing, in other words. Do we really want someone armed with nuclear weapons guessing as to whether or not they've launched an attack on us? Sooner or later, somebody's going to make the wrong guess. And once a nuclear war starts, and as you said, it's use them or lose them. If you don't get them out of their silos, they're going to get you. And it's completely crazy. But that's the plan. In Daniel Ellsberg's new book, The Doomsday Machine, one of the reasons he wrote it was because there was a plan, and I don't know whether we still have the same plan, because we don't know this for certain, but there was a plan during the Eisenhower administration, and we don't think of the Eisenhower as a particularly crazy person, and it was to launch a first strike at every city of 25,000 or more in Russia and China and military concentrations in Eastern Europe. When Ellsberg asked how many people that would kill, the military assessed that it would kill 600 million people. Now, keep in mind that the population of the world back in the 1950s was 3 billion. It's 7.6 million today. And What the study didn't include was that they had no concept of nuclear winter. So they didn't account for the smoke or anything that would result of that. And in a recent study by Rutgers and the University of California in Los Angeles, they estimated what would be the impact of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which both sides exchanged 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs. And what they found, that it would generate between 1 and 5 million tons of smoke, that it would essentially make impossible the growing of wheat in Russia and Canada.
Because it would dampen the sun so long.
Absolutely. It would also remove between 25 and 70% of the ozone layer in the Northern Hemisphere, which the resulting cancer-causing ultraviolet radiation. And it would reduce the monsoon by rainfall by about 20% and worldwide rain by about 10%. So Pakistan and India, which you don't think of as, you know, they don't have the kind of force that we have, would essentially kill probably 100 million people. That's the thing that's so crazy about nuclear weapons, is that we have all of these weapons. They are on hair trigger. There is no difference between the way the system that we had in the midst of the Cold War, when things were on a hair trigger, than today. They are still on hair trigger. And you don't need a big button to push them. When Trump talked about his big button, what most people don't realize, and what Ellsberg's book clearly demonstrates, is that in fact, there are literally thousands of people that can start a nuclear war. In not just between the United States and Russia and China, but also in Pakistan and India.
Explain that, what that kind of scenario would look like. How does someone who's not the head of state start a nuclear war?
Well, this is what I think. I think you raised the thing about Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So here's what happens. Communications between shore and ship, they're tricky. So here you have an Ohio-class submarine. It's armed with 24 Trident II missiles. Those missiles will be armed with either W-76s or W-88. So anywhere, the average Ohio submarine could pack a force of a little over 91,000 kilotons in one submarine. Okay. So the report comes in that there's a missile headed for Hawaii, and suddenly communications go down. So you're the captain of Ohio submarine. If somebody launched a war, communications would go down. You're not out there alone. There are hunter-killer subs, both Russian and Chinese, that are tracking you or trying to track you. And their job is to take you out before you can launch your missiles. What do you do? Use them or lose them. could certainly start that way. It could start...
And the captain of that sub has the authority, absent communication from Washington, to hit the fire button.
If they didn't...
You're talking about 91,000 kilotons. If I'm doing the math right, you are talking about 6,000 Hiroshimas.
Yes, yes. I mean, actually, that Ohio-class submarine would probably put a permanent dent, or at least for a long time, in civilization as a whole, not just in one particular area. And you think about it, that's the logic of nuclear weapons. If you relied on the big button, or the what they call the football, when the U.S. carried it, then all you had to do is decapitate Washington, and you wouldn't have a nuclear war. The Russians call it dead hand. You take out Moscow, some general in the Urals has the authority to launch those missiles. Some captain of a missile-firing submarine in the Sea of Okhotsk has the authority to launch those missiles. Because if they didn't, they were going to get knocked out anyhow, and you essentially lose the war. Nobody's going to lose a war. Well, instead, what we do is we lose civilization. And you know, I think that. Again, it's hard to get your head around this. I mean, the closest thing I could think of what would happen in a real nuclear war would be at the end of the Permian, 252 million years ago, something very bad happened to the planet. Combination of massive volcanic explosions, maybe you know, comet or meteor hits, and probably the release of huge amounts of carbon dioxide that were frozen in the Arctic Ocean, that killed 96% of life in the sea and about 70% of life on Earth. That's what we were looking at here. We're looking at essentially the Permian-Triassic Great Extinction event. I mean, would it kill every human being on Earth? I don't know. Maybe there would be, you know, little groups of people living in southern New Zealand that could live on mollusks or something like that. But it would essentially be the end of human civilization.
And yet, in the very brief history of the nuclear age that we've lived through so far, the near misses we have actually showed people in the chain of command's unwillingness to actually execute Armageddon.
There's no question, and Ellsberg gives the example of the Cuban Missile Crisis, uh-huh, of where there was a Soviet submarine and the U.S. was harassing it. They weren't really dropping live depth charges. They were doing practice depth charges. The Russians didn't know that. What we didn't know, what the U.S. didn't know, was that the Russians had a nuclear torpedo. And the captain and the first, in his second in command, essentially asked for permission to take out one of these cruisers with a nuclear torpedo. And the only thing that stopped it was there was a Russian Commodore on board the ship, and he vetoed it. Now, the thing is to say, yeah, there are people in command, in the chain of command, who have stopped it. How long will this happen? I mean, if you apply math, probability theory, you take the number of nuclear weapons, you put all that together, nobody ever comes up with zero for the possibility of avoiding a nuclear war. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. I mean, Murphy's Law, whatever you want to call it. When you have people who have the ability to do this, sooner or later, somebody's going to panic. Somebody's going to do something. Let me give you an example of the way which I think it could immediately happen. India and Pakistan. India has a military strategy called Cold Start, and it gives... what it is that the Indian Army reserves the right to advance 30 kilometers into Pakistan in pursuit of terrorists or whatever, okay? The Pakistani Army, which is far smaller than the Indian Army, has given frontline commanders the right to use tactical nuclear weapons. Suppose a Pakistan colonel thinks that maybe this is an Indian invasion. His troops are getting beat, so he launches a tactical nuclear weapon. The Indians don't have tactical nuclear weapons. They just have strategic nuclear weapons. The Indians have said they will respond to tactical nuclear weapons with the full strategic things. Tactical nuclear weapons are small warheads. Actually, Hiroshima is considered a tactical nuclear weapon, 15 kilotons. The Indians would respond with much bigger warheads, and they would nuke cities And suddenly you'd have a general exchange, and we're back to that scenario that what would be the effect worldwide of an exchange between India and Pakistan. That can happen because some colonel, Pakistani colonel, made a decision or panicked or whatever and launched a tactical nuke. And suddenly we're talking about 100 million people dead. And worldwide effect. I mean, we in the Northern Hemisphere would have to deal with the possibility that we would have 70% of the ozone layer removed. I mean, for the Irish with freckles, we would be in deep trouble.
We started the discussion talking about the situation with North Korea. It actually sounds like that's not what you're most concerned with.
I am concerned with North Korea. I'm very concerned with North Korea. And what I want to do is I'm trying to say is I'm very concerned with North Korea. It's sort of like the old